This audio is brought to you by MuslimCentral.com.
So, hello everyone. Salam. Namaste. Adab. And welcome to today's event with Professor Jonathan Brown of Georgetown University. The topic of today's event is South Asian Islamic Thought. And I have invited a very senior academician here in the community, Dr. Mozam Siddiqui, who is quite familiar with Professor Brown's work as well as the department's work at Georgetown. So he is going to give you a formal introduction of Professor Brown and of the theme. So welcome, Dr. Mozam Siddiqui, sir, and please start.
So it gives me great pleasure to introduce Dr. Jonathan Brown, who's a professor at the Prince Al-Walid bin Talal Chair of Islamic Civilization at the School of Foreign Service at Georgetown University. And he has been Georgetown has been his alma mater. And he was an undergraduate here in 2000 to 2004. And since
I graduated in 2000, my wife was 2003 or something, but I was 2000.
Yeah, and so it so happens that I have lived in Washington since 1984, and I was at the University of California, Berkeley. And so even though my field is comparative linguistics and comparative literature, but I have also, in the area, the same area as Dr. Brown. And that's why it gives me great pleasure. And I have heard a lot about him, and he's such a young and promising scholar, already has produced so many books and written so many articles. And in order to be a student of civilization and religion, you have to know several languages. So he knows Arabic, Persian. He has also been to India, knows Urdu. And I think you also—
Yeah, a little bit of Urdu, very, very small.
But I think you also know a little bit of Turkish, I'm sure.
Yeah.
And he has written several books, but I'm going to mention only three here. Canonization of Al-Bukhari and Muslim, the formation and function of the Sunni Hadith canon. And number two, Hadith, Muhammad's legacy in the medieval and modern world. And number three, Muhammad, a very short introduction. And Professor Brown got his PhD from one of the premier institutions, not only in the United States, but throughout the world, the University of Chicago and the Department of Islamic Studies and Civilization at the University of Chicago has had many distinguished professors. And I can think of late Professor Hodgson, who wrote a three-volume book on the history, civilization, all aspects of Islam in the context of world history. So he was unfortunately not there when Professor Brown was attending University of Chicago. And also I can think of Professor Fazlur Rahman, who joined University of Chicago in the late 50s because he was in Pakistan during the regime of General Ayub Khan. And he was hounded out from Pakistan by the orthodox ulama of Pakistan. And he has written many books. And one of his books, which is very famous, is Islam, a very short book. And so many other distinguished scholars. And very briefly, speaking about South Asia, or I should say the Indian subcontinent and Islam. So I'll give you very brief outlines, very hallmarks during the contact between India and the world of Islam. So I begin with a famous hadith, which is quoted by many scholars. Prophet Muhammad reported to have said, "I feel cool breeze from India." And then the contact with India of the Islamic world, not only the Arab, I mean, not the Arab world, it predates the advent of Islam, the contact between the Gulf states and the Malabar coast. So we have the first mosque that was built in India dates back to 726, and that mosque is still there and has been continuously used in Kerala. And then after that, let me take you to the contact with the Umayyad Caliphate. Muhammad bin Qasim, the young general, conquered Sindh and Multan. And after that, the other high point is the contact with the medieval world, great civilizations, Greek, and then later on Alexandria, which was also Greek and Roman, and the ancient civilizations, Iran and Turan and Sumeria and India. So India is known for its science, mathematics. So the numbering system was taken from India by the Arabs, and at the Darul Hikmah, the house of wisdom that was established by Harun Rashid. And that's where the numbers were used by the Arabs and developed the science of mathematics, algebra, and other sciences. And they called it in Arabic, Hindsa, which means they are acknowledging the origin of numbers to India. Whereas the Europeans who received the numbering system from the Arabs, they call it the Arabic numerals. After that, we have the contact between the Turanians and Iranians, the invasion of Mahmud Ghaznavi. And then the histories after Mahmud Ghaznavi is quite well known to you. And let me also mention a very famous name, Abu Rehan al-Biruni, who spent 13 years in India and studied Sanskrit for a lot of years. And he wrote an encyclopedic book on India. It is literally an encyclopedia called, a very long title, but in English it is called The Book of India, in which he talks about history, anthropology, languages, philosophy, cultures, and all that. And after that, we have so many other dynasties until we come to the Mughal dynasty. And since after that, the history of Islam during the Mughal period, and then the British come. And after that, so I think I have given you enough background, the contact between India and the Indian subcontinent and the Islamic world. So let's give it back to Professor Jonathan Brown.
Assalamu alaikum, everybody. I'm really happy to be here. And, thanks for inviting me and for showing up. I think a lot of times if I could go back and kind of redo my career, I would focus on South Asian history. I'm going to say Indian today, India, just because it's easier than saying South Asia. But of course, I mean kind of the whole of the subcontinent. I'm not politically pushing for support of India over the modern nation state of India over some other country. So to make it that clear. I mean, it's just such an interesting, part of Islamic history. I mean, I'm really interested in sort of India in Islamic history. I confess I'm not super interested in pre-Islamic India. I mean, it's not, I'm not interested in it, but I'm really interested in kind of South Asia as part of the Islamic world. And I think one of the reasons I'm really interested is because you have a situation in which Muslims are a minority. You know, at the most, if you take sort of South Asia as a whole, kind of max out at about one quarter of the population, I think. And, you know, they have a lot of different relationships to the people around them, to the context they're in. They're traders, like on the Malabar coast, as Professor Sheik was saying. They're traders at first, then they're remove this. Then they're raiders coming from the northwest under the, you know, well, first they're kind of conquerors during the time of Muhammad al-Qasim in Sindh. Then they're kind of raiders under the Ghaznavids, who sort of set up camp in Afghanistan and later on in the Punjab. And then they come and settle as rulers from and settlers in during the time of the Delhi Sultanate, roughly from, you know, around 1192 onward. And then they gradually basically blend in with the indigenous population and become fully part of Indian history, right? So this idea of Muslims as foreigners or as outsiders is, you know, it might be true at the very beginning in the sense that they're merchants or that they're warriors or something, but they very quickly blend in and create a kind of composite society and composite civilization. And you can see this with the various states of, you know, the kind of successor states of the Delhi Sultanate. And then you, of course, see it most clearly with the Mughals. And I really, if you're interested, I recommend reading Richard Eaton's relatively new book called India in the Persianate Age, which is a fascinating, excellent review from a great, great scholar who knows all the regional languages that are important to know. And he's just a terrific scholar in general. Richard Eaton's India in a Persianate, in the Persianate Age. And what he shows is that the kind of the idea of Persianate culture is a culture that is a period in Indian history, the kind of between the Delhi Sultanate and the kind of the 1830s and 1840s when the British really start to enforce their authority, their cultural and colonial authority. It's a period in which Persian language, Persian literature, Persian sensibilities are become a medium for everybody in India to communicate and express themselves, whether they're Muslim, whether they're various types of Hindu, whether they're, et cetera. So anything you can imagine, you know, Zoroastrian. So Persianate becomes this kind of religiously neutral language of artist, of art and communication and aesthetics and scholarship that flourishes under this under this period of Muslim rule in history in India. And what he also shows, and I mean, this is been shown by other people before, but I think he does a great job of bringing this information together, is that, you know, all these Muslim states, you know, from the time of the Delhi Sultanate onward, they're not foreign states, right? They're Muslims ruling in India as Indian rulers. So the way they show themselves on coins, the way they legitimize themselves, the way they structure their states, the way they structure their alliances, they're Indian rulers like Indian rulers were acting 1,000 years before them. And he shows that the Mughal Empire, especially after the time of Akbar, is really in a lot of ways, it's a Rajput rule. They're Rajputs, right? The way genetically, I mean, by the time you get to like someone like Shah Jahan or Aurangzeb, these people are like half or two or three fourths Rajput. You know, I mean, they're, the language they speak at home when they're, you know, yelling at their kids and stuff is a dialect of essentially North Indian, right? So And they create this, this, you know, composite artistic style, composite political style, composite court culture, everything, literature. And that's really fascinating, because you have, you know, how do you live as Muslims as a minority? You know, first as kind of traders, then as rulers, then as rulers who are at home in that land with its language, with its culture. And then, of course, what really interests me is then they start to have to live as subjects of the British. You know, first, you know, maybe they're just accepting their protection or working with them. Then they're, you know, maybe a little bit more dependent on them, then a little bit more dependent on them. And then finally, very clearly, the British are in charge. How do you make sense of that as a Muslim? Then the kind of the British start to maybe be a little bit more forceful about things like missionary activity, about you know, creating a kind of upper class, an anglicized anglophone upper class. How do Muslims make sense of that? How do they make sense of modernity? In a lot of ways, one of the reasons I really, really like kind of Islam in South Asia as a subject is because these are the first people, the first Muslims who come face to face with the challenge of modernity. You know, the challenge of modernity that is for them also the challenge of the West. So I think that's really, you know, in a lot of ways, Islamic thought since 1800 is a repetition or rehashing the discussions that Indian Muslims are having from around 1800, right? So they're the first people to have these discussions, and they create all the germs of this discussion, and then kind of everybody else just sort of rehashes it over and over again. And so that's why I really find it fascinating. So I'm also not, but this is not my expertise. So in some, you know, when I was invited to give this presentation, I said, you know, I don't really know what to talk about. It's not my expertise, but I do my best to learn about it. And I take Indian Muslim scholarship very, very, very seriously. And that's not because I'm some kind of, you know, sensitive, charitable person. It's because anybody who dips even a finger into Indian Islamic scholarship immediately takes it very, very seriously, because these people are not jokes. They are no joke whatsoever. I mean, just as a brief statement, I mean, a brief introduction, right? If you want to find the best writings on Hadith commentary, Hanafi law, some of the best writings on Islamic theology from the 1800s until through the 20th century until today, you're talking about Indian scholars without a doubt, in terms of volume, in terms of quality. If you, you know, I remember, you know, I wrote this book on Islam and slavery, and I looked at all the different Hadith commentaries on the Hadiths involved, and you know, it's interesting, and you see the same ideas coming up over and over again. And then I read Mufti Taqi Usmani's Takmilat Fath al-Mulhim on Sahih Muslim, and he just took everything to the next level. I mean, and you see this over and over again with Mufti Taqi Usmani, with his writing, is that he'll always take the conversation to another level of quality and comprehensiveness. And you know, so you're talking about somebody who's not summarizing the golden ages of the past. You're talking about somebody who's participating in that tradition and moving it forward and building on it in a way that's completely organically a continuation of that past. And that's someone who's alive today, right? So, you know, you can imagine the figures like, you know, Shamsuddin Azim Abadi, Muhammad Zakaria Kandahlawi, Zafar Ahmad Osmani, Ashraf Ali Tanvi, Anwar Shah Kashmiri, right? I mean, these figures are you know, immense scholars, and they're incredible scholars, incredible. So this is a book I've been reading, and I got this in the Da'arat al-Ma'arif al-Uthmaniya in Hyderabad. I got one of my favorite intellectual pilgrimages was to go to actually the the Da'irat al-Ma'arif al-Uthmaniya at Osmania University in Hyderabad, and visit that place where so many great Islamic texts were edited and published for the first time. And I bought a lot of books there, of course, and I got them, remember, I got them bound in the Chandni Chowk district in Delhi, with a very nice little Muslim bookbinder shop, and I went and had meals with them, and they're a wonderful family. And so this is the Nuzhat al-Khawatir of Abdul Hayy al-Hassani of Nadwa. And it's a, you know, early mid 20th century Muslim scholar who does a history of all the ulama and kind of leading figures, political, literary, intellectual figures of Islam in South Asia. And up till kind of, I think, the early 20th century. And so if you look here, you can see, sorry for my horrible handwriting, but so this is actually by Hijri century. And this is really interesting because you can kind of see the volume of Muslim intellectual activity. So, okay, so volume 7 at the top is essentially, this is rough, but basically the 1800s to into the little 1900s of the Common Era, right? So you can think of the time of scholar, the Shah Abdulaziz of Dehlawi died 1825. You think of, you know, Fadlallah al-Azimabadi, sorry, al-Khairabadi, and Shah Ismail al-Shahid, and the kind of founders of Deoband and Ferengi Mehel in the top volume. Then you go below that, you're basically into the 1700s of the Common Era. So you have, sorry, I'm holding this up, it's sort of unstable, but I'll do my best. The 1700s, which is, you know, of course, Shah Wali Allah Dehlawi and the figures of revival and reform in India, 1700s. You go down to volume 5, which is roughly the 1600s. You can think of figures like Abdul Haq al-Dihlawi, who died, I think, in 1642 or 1052 Hijri, around 1642 of the Common Era. And then below that is the 1500s, volume 4. And you can see these are voluminous. And then below that, volume 3 is into the 1500s. And you can see there's a real kind of drop in volume. Oh, wait, so let me think here. No. So, okay, I'm sorry. So volume 4 would be the 1500s. Volume 5 is the 1600s. Volume 6 is the 1700s. Volume 8 is the 1800s, right? So volume 4 in the 1500s, you see it's still pretty high volume. But then you get into volume 3 in the 1400s, Common Era, then you start really see a, you know, we're going back in time, right? So things are kind of going, getting smaller and smaller, kind of the beginning of the tree as it starts to blossom. And then before that into the 1300s, and before that into the 1200s. And before that, it's kind of not really a thing, right? So, but you see, it's really in the 1500s that you have the explosion of intellectual activity. And a lot of that is, I think, because of the kind of blossoming of the Mughal state. But I think this is, it's really interesting because you just see the sheer volume of Muslim intellectual activity. Now, what's really interesting is, for me, is and I say this in no way to detract from the sort of piety or sincerity or value of any part of the Muslim world. But, and I also say this as a huge fan of kind of Islam in West Africa and Sub-Saharan Africa. But if you look at kind of compare Islamic scholarship in India and Islamic scholarship in Sub-Saharan Africa, like let's say the kind of West African world of Timbuktu and Mali, they're, in a lot of ways, their histories are parallel in the sense that you get, you know, early trade contact, you get sort of the beginning of conversion of some rulers and courts in Sub-Saharan Africa in the early 1000s. You get kind of the rise of Muslims, very wealthy Muslim states in the 1200s, 1300s, 1400s, 1500s, like the great big empires like Mali and Songhai. And the you know, when famous pilgrimage of King Mansa Musa from from Mali when he goes in the 1300s to do his Hajj, and a Muslim scholar from the Hejaz actually goes back to Mali with him, and he's really stunned by the quality of Maliki jurists. Like, he says, you know, the scholars here really know what they're doing. These aren't some, you know, these aren't kind of country bumpkins who don't know anything. He's really impressed with the scholarship there. So the kind of quality of Islamic scholarship in sub-Saharan Africa is very high from an early period, in terms of Maliki law. And one thing they write a lot of is praise of the Prophet, just endless volumes of praising the Prophet. It's an incredible devotion. But what's really interesting is they don't, I do not think there is a single commentary on Hadith written in Africa, in sort of West Africa, south of the Sahara, as far as I know. There's some written in like Ethiopia, Somalia region, but it's a very different, like you compare that to South Asia, where, I mean, you get to the point in the 1700s and 1800s where any scholar worth his salt write a commentary on Sahih Bukhari or Sahih Muslim, just as they, it's like, you know, you have to do it. It's like, you know, something you have to have on your resume. So and what's really interesting is there are a few books by West African Muslim scholars that are used in the rest of the Muslim world, a very small number. If you look at the number of books that are considered authoritative references by Indian scholars, they're used throughout the Muslim world, it's a large number, right? So, I mean, first of all, I am not in any way saying that sort of the Arab world is the standard by which things are measured, but I'm just talking about, let's look at sort of the spread. You know, we'll look at the Arab world or the Ottoman world as just examples of things spreading to other places. If you go to a bookstore in Cairo or in Istanbul, either this year or 100 years ago, you'll find, you know, books like Allahumma sayyid Muhammad, Al-Mubarak Furi's or Mubarak Puri's commentary on the collection of Tirmidhi. You'll see Zakaria Kandahlawi's commentary on the Muwatta of Malik. You'll see some of the earliest books printed in Islamic theology in a printed press include Abdul Hakim Sialkuti, the famous 17th century Indian scholar, Sialkuti's commentary on the Aqidah of An-Nasafi, right? You'll see, Allahumma sayyid Muhammad, you'll see the Masharik al-Anwar of Saghani. Saghani died in 1252, one of the earliest Muslim scholars from India, who travels to Baghdad, and he does a very authoritative copy of Sahih Bukhari. He writes his own hadith collection called the Masharik al-Anwar, which is very popular throughout the Muslim world. So I'm just trying to think of other examples. Allahumma sayyid Muhammad. Of course, the Fatawa al-Hindiya, right? The Fatawa al-Alamgiri that's commissioned by Emperor Aurangzeb in the late 1600s. This book it's called the Fatawa al-Hindiya, the Indian Fatwa. I mean, this is a book that is, cited and by Hanafi scholars in the Ottoman world. You know, an incredible book to this day, an incredible resource for understanding the Hanafi school of law. And I could go on and on with about works written by Indian scholars that are really authoritative and widespread around the Islamic world. Okay. So here's an interesting question. Why is this? Why is there such a kind of intense and voluminous production of Muslim scholarship in South Asia, especially from essentially the 1400s onward? And I would say that from my theory, I mean, probably other people have already talked about this, but I'm not a specialist, I'm just doing my best, right? I think there's a huge number of very powerful and wealthy Muslim states that emerge after the Delhi Sultanate. So the Delhi Sultanate is very interesting, right? As I said, it kind of emerges around 1200 in Delhi. And By the time you get to, there's a series of different dynasties in the Delhi Sultanate. As you know, you can all go read about that if you don't already know about it. But by the time it kind of starts to fall apart in the mid-1300s, late 1300s, and then, of course, Tamerlane comes in the late 1300s and sacks Delhi, and that's a very traumatic event. But really, in a lot of ways, the scene of Muslim South Asia is already established. So the Delhi Sultanate expands significantly southward into the Deccan Plateau. So they, it's not like the, when you look at sort of the Mughal conquest of India, does not go that much farther beyond what the Delhi Sultanate had conquered. And when Tamerlane comes and sacks Delhi, the successor states to the Delhi Sultanate are really impressive states, right? You have the Qutb Shahi dynasty in Golconda, the Nizam Shahis, I think in Hyderabad. You have the Adil Shahis in Bijapur. You have the Ahmednagar. You have the Bahmanis in Daulatabad, and you have this rise of Gujarat, especially in the 1400s. And what's interesting is although Tamerlane comes and causes political chaos, and it's very traumatic in terms of the number of lives lost, the 1400s in India is actually a time of incredible cultural and intellectual efflorescence. So Tamerlane's legacy is, I mean, not that your history is made by people like Tamerlane alone, right? But if you think about the 1400s, sort of the aftermath of Tamerlane, it's a time of incredible productivity and growth. And that's really interesting, right? So, and then when the Mughals come to power, a lot of their time through the 1600s is just spent conquering and defeating these other Muslim states to their south, as well as, of course, states like the Rajputs. So that's why I think when you look at Islam in India in the 1400s onward, you're looking at a number of really powerful, rich, committed Muslim states that are very interested in patronizing Muslim scholarship. And you can see just the extent to which places like Daulatabad under the Bahmanis, or Bijapur, or Ahmednagar, or Golconda, in the 1400s, just, I mean, creating madrasas. Every time a big scholar comes, let's build this guy a madrasa, right? After the Tamerlane's invasion, Jaunpur becomes a really important center in what's now, I think it would be Bihar, if I'm not mistaken, right? Correct me if I'm wrong. Jaunpur becomes a major center.
Eastern UP.
Oh, Eastern UP. Okay, thanks. So all, you know, a lot of scholars who flee Delhi when Tamerlane invades go to Jaunpur, where they are received under the Shalki dynasty, supported, given madrasas are built for them. I mean, I'll say this, it's not unique. This is not unique in Islamic history by any stretch, but Muslim rulers in India really honored the ulama. They really honored them, and they patronized them, and they supported them. And so you have immense, and of course, not just ulama of law, but of course, they love Sufism. You know, they love Sufism, and you all know this, right? So, you know, the extent to which they honored and followed Sufi saints. So you had, whereas in a place like West Africa, you have, I think, a couple of centers that are very wealthy, like Timbuktu or Gao. In South Asia, you have, you know, half a dozen, maybe a dozen such places that are just poor. And this is another thing which you realize is the extent to which South Asia was the land of, it was the, you know, how do I say this? It was like, you know, the land of milk and honey or something. It was a land, it was like El Dorado, you know? It was, for Muslim scholars, and you see this in the 1400s and 1500s, it was a place you would go and really make it big as a Muslim scholar. And what you start seeing is, especially in the 1400s, scholars from Baghdad, from Aleppo, from Cairo, from the Hejaz, from Yemen, moving to India, to places like Gujarat, to places like Daulatabad, to places like Jaunpur, to becoming extremely wealthy and kind of secure I mean, this is where they go to, you know, get their tenure track job, you know? And so you can see in the kind of the streams of influence on Indian Islam, there is Yemen and the Hejaz to Gujarat, especially in the, and after the Safavids conquer Iran in after 1501, there's an exodus because the Safavids forcibly convert Iran to Shiism. And so a lot of Sunni ulama flee Safavid lands. Some of them go through Central Asia, Samarkand, Bukhara, right, Herat, into India. Some of them come through the Persian Gulf to Gujarat. And there's a huge influx. So you have the legacy of Mamluk scholarship, Mamluk era scholarship from Egypt and the Hejaz going through Gujarat. You have the Central Asian scholarship of Sharif al-Jurjani, Saaduddin al-Taftazani in the late 1300s, coming, their students are coming into India through Central Asia, right down to the south. And so you have kind of Hanafism, Hanafi school of law, Maturidi and Ashari school of theology coming from the north. You have Shafi school of law coming from the kind of Indian Ocean direction and finding homes in all these new Muslim states, which is, I think, and you can see, like, as you go through the, as you read through the Nuzhat al-Khawatir, you see the names change of where scholars go. Where are the scholarly centers? You know, of course, Delhi is important. Then Jaunpur becomes really important. In the 1400s, Daulatabad and Malwa under the Bahmanis, Bijapur, Ahmednagar, Gujarat, a place called Sambal, especially during the Mughal period, the areas around Delhi become very important. I think it's called the Doab. How do you say this in Urdu?
Yes. Anybody know what? Yes, Doab.
Doab, yeah. So Doab. Places like Bilgram, Sambal, later...
Western UP. Western UP.
Yeah, exactly. Kandla, Deoband, right? So these places become very important as Delhi becomes the center of power, right? Okay. Now, Allahumma says it. All right. Yeah, I think I covered this. Okay. And what's also very interesting is you see from the 1400s onward, a really extensive and strong connection of Indian ulama and the Hejaz. Of course, this is partially through doing the Hajj, right? So it's not like Indian ulama are the only Muslims in the world to do Hajj. Of course, a lot of people do Hajj. But they seem to do it in a lot larger number. And I think it was arguably easier to do. This is just my theory off the top of my head. Because you could, you basically go to Gujarat and then you get on a boat and you go to Mecca. I mean, and that trade route, as was mentioned, you know, in the introduction, it's really from around the time of Christ. I mean, you're talking about the kind of Hellenistic period when Greek navigators figure out that they can just go straight across. They don't have to go along the land. They can just go straight across from the Babylon Mandab and end up in India. And they can use the monsoon winds to do this. So this is a well-traveled route. And what you see is that in a lot of ways, the Hejaz becomes in some ways a location of Indian Muslim scholarship. In the 1400s, you have figures like Muhammad bin Ahmed Nahrawali from, I guess the place is Nahwala in Gujarat. Does anyone know that place?
Nahwala, yeah.
Yeah. He dies in about 1600 of the Common Era, or maybe 1590 of the Common Era. So he and his father both go to the Hejaz and they become such establishments that there's actually to this day one of the doors, I think, of the mosque in Mecca is actually called the Bab of Nahawala, if I'm not mistaken. But I have to check that. But I mean, Ibn Hajar Haytami, who's a huge Shafi scholar, originally from Egypt, he settles in Mecca, huge influential Shafi scholar in Egypt. He dies in about 1567, the Common Era. His job, his salary is paid in a madrasa that is founded and funded by Sultan Mahmud of Gujarat. Right? So there's this symbiotic, you know, relationship between the Hejaz and especially the Gujarat, but not just Gujarat, right? Indian scholars from throughout India will travel there. And what's really interesting is from the 1400s, 1500s onward, this constant pattern of Muslim, of Indian scholars going and studying in the Hejaz. And what's interesting, and I think this it certainly explains their expertise in Hadith, is that they bring the intensive tradition of Hadith scholarship from the Hejaz to India in the 1500s, but really especially in the 1600s with Abdul Haq Dehlawi, and then in the 1700s with Shah Wali Allah and his tradition, right? So India becomes the place where Hadith are studied in essence after the 1700s, because of this, it kind of inherits this strong, maybe, no one really has ever explained how this happened, but somehow Hejaz in the 1500s becomes this dynamic place for the study of Hadith. All right. And by the way, what's really interesting, I think I talked about this already. Yeah. Sorry, I just want to make sure I'm not missing anything. Okay, so what's really interesting is not just the way in which India kind of is heir to this Hejazi study of Hadith, but also has this element of revival and reform, even from an early period. Now, in terms of history of Islamic thought, people usually use the term revival and reform for the 1700s. So the movements like Shah Wali Allah in India, Sanani in Yemen, Sokoto Caliphate in what's now northern Nigeria, the Wahhabi movement in Central Arabia. So these movements in the 1700s are talked about as a period of revival and reform in Islamic thought and in the Islamic world. But a lot of these trends are actually present in India actually before, even in the 1500s, which is very interesting. And it clearly comes from the Hejaz. Just to give you an example, and I think he's also a great example because you can kind of, just like people talk about kind of like Team Aurangzeb or Team Dara Shikoh, like which side are you on? You can see those two sort of teams back into the 1500s already, right? Sort of let's call it more, maybe a more accretionist or more interested in affirming dialogue with Indian tradition versus a more, let's say, like orthodox, stringent approach to Islamic law and practice. You can see this in the 1500s. One of my students is doing his paper on this, and I hope he publishes it. There's a figure called Abdennebi el-Gangohi, who is essentially a contemporary with Akbar, because he's Akbar's tutor, and then he serves as the sadr, like the main kind of sheikh al-Islam in the Mughal court for many years, until eventually he falls out of favor with Akbar and he is exiled. But what's very interesting about Abdennebi el-Gangohi is he wrote a book called Sunan al-Huda fi Mutabi'at al-Mustafa, so the sunnah of guidance in following the chosen one, the Prophet Muhammad. And he wrote it in Arabic, and I don't think it's been published, but we found a manuscript of it. And it's a very interesting book. It's essentially a book of the fiqh of ibadah, of different worship, you know, fasting, praying, hajj, things like that. And that's done with reference to hadith. Now that's not unusual. He's not the first person to do this. But what's really interesting is the way that he talks about the Hejaz in his understanding of Islam. And repeatedly in the book, he criticizes various practices in India that he sees as bid'ah, as unacceptable heresy. And his reference for that is the practice of the Hejaz and the scholars of the Hejaz. So it's really interesting that one thing he talks about, he says that for example, he'll say that the khatib leaning on a cane, on a wooden cane, is, it's sunnah. And how do we know this? This is the practice of the ulama of the Haramain of Mecca and Medina. He says the two rakahs, and you all can tell me if this is actually something that's done in India. I don't know. Two rakahs prayed at night where you read Ayat al-Kursi. Does anyone do this? Anyone ever heard of this? Okay. Maybe the Nebi got his way here. He says, this has no basis in any hadiths from the Prophet. And the Arabs don't do it. So I know this is, I don't want anyone to get upset here. But he's saying basically the Arabs should be our reference point. He says, Jum'ah is fard. So Jum'ah, and this is, and again, maybe someone can tell me about this. I should probably have looked this up before I talk to you. But there's a debate about whether or not, especially in the Hanafi school, whether or not Jum'ah is really required. Because there's some debate about whether it can happen with like a non-unjust leader or a kind of a non-legitimate Muslim ruler. He says Jum'ah is fard, this requirement, until the Day of Judgment. And doesn't matter if the ruler is just or not just. And the way we know this is the ulama of the Haramain, they do not pray Dhuhr on Friday, right? They pray Jum'ah and that's it. They don't pray Jum'ah and then pray Dhuhr in case the Jum'ah wasn't valid. And then this is really interesting. He says any practice that's allowed, so it's mubah, it's allowed, but the juhal, the kind of ignorant people, they start to think that it's required or it's part of the sunnah, it becomes prohibited. And by the way, this is a kind of foreshadowing the debate over the mawlid, the kind of Deobandi versus Barelvi debate over the mawlid, where the Deobandis say, there's nothing wrong with honoring the Prophet, of course, and his birthday. But if people start getting to the point where they think this is something you have to do, this is part of Islamic practice, then you ban it because you don't want people to get that this is this sort of slippery slope into altering what is actually required versus not required. Versus the Barelbis who say, look, if there's nothing wrong with doing it, and if it's a good thing to do, then people should do it. But you see here with Abdul Nabi Gangohi in the 1500s, already this idea of we need to, this thing is because the fact people start thinking it's required or good or part of the sunnah, that is a reason to prohibit it. All right. And I could go into other examples, but I won't, of figures in the 1500s and 1600s in India who start to do things like one figure, Allahumma says Muhammad, is Abdusalam al-Diwi. In the 1600s, who would break with the main ruling of the Hanafi school if he felt that that ruling did not follow the usul of the Hanafi school. So this is interesting. He's getting to the point of being what's called a mujtahid in the madhab. He doesn't go by what the kind of established rule of the madhab is. If he feels like that rule is not true to the madhab's own principle. Then in the next century, the 1700s, of course, you get figures like Shah Wali Allah Dihlawi and others who are willing to even break with, go outside the Hanafi madhab, break with every madhab and consider themselves to be mujtahids who can move between madhabs based on following hadiths. Okay. I don't know how much longer I'm supposed to talk for. I forgot.
Well, you can continue for another 10 minutes.
Okay. Now, it's a... it's interesting to compare that sort of, we'll call it, you know, more, it's not just orthodox, right? It's because it's, you know, being a Hanafi, someone like Abdul Haq al-Dihlawi in the 1600s, he says very clearly in some of his books, you know, you follow the madhab, you follow one of the four madhabs, and that's what you do. You don't question that. You don't, you know, this is how to be a rightly guided Muslim, right? There's nothing wrong with just being a regular, good old fashioned Hanafi, Maturidi, Naqshbandi Sufi or something like that. That's perfectly fine. But someone like Abdelnaby Gongohi is even pushing further than that. He's saying that, you know, we need to always be examining our practice and comparing it to the Sunnah of the Prophet. For him, that's best understood through the practice of the ulama of Mecca and Medina. Now, on the other hand, you have this more, I don't want to call it syncretic, right? Because I don't think that someone like Dara Shikoh or Chishti Sufi scholars in India are somehow heretical. I don't think that they don't care about Islam or that they are interested in some kind of hybrid, you know, watered down version of Islam that's mixed with Hinduism, or that's, you know, I think that they're very committed Muslims, but they're really interested and they're willing to think about elements of the Indian religious traditions that are aiming at the same point or aiming at the same objective as the mystical traditions of Islam. And this is why when people talk about, you know, Dara Shikoh as, you know, or as peers like Mirza Mazhar Jana Jinan and people like that in Delhi in the 1700s, that they're somehow, you know, accept Indian religion or accept Hinduism or something, I think that's inaccurate. They accept certain types of Hinduism. They accept certain strains within Hinduism. They accept the monotheistic mystical strain that talks about, you know, seeking union with the divine and the one, right? That they see that as the same conversation that Muslims, that the Sufi tradition in Islam has, especially the kind of Ibn Arabi tradition. But that doesn't mean that they think that it's, you know, makes perfect sense to worship an idol or to have a temple that has, you know, statues of this, that, and the other, right? So it's not about affirming Hinduism as a family of religions. It's about them being interested in a specific strain within Hinduism, the kind of monotheistic element, non-dualistic monotheism. So I think in Aditya Vedanta, I think is the term in Hindu tradition. You see this with figures like Dara Shikoh when he commissions the something called Multaqa al-Abhur, the meeting of the seas, the confluence of the seas, where he looks at the kind of Hindu mystic tradition, monotheistic mystic tradition, and the Islamic mystical tradition, and sort of shows comparison and similarities in their concepts and vocabulary. And then with his Sir al-Asrar, the Secrets of Secrets, which is a translation and commentary on the Upanishads, which is, it's very interesting. One scholar, I recommend reading a book on this. It's called The Emperor Who Never Was, by Supriya Gandhi. It's a very good book. It's very readable and informative about Dara Shikoh. And she talks about it as, in some ways, this the Sir al-Asrar is like a commentary on the Quran from the perspective of the Upanishads, or a commentary on the Upanishads through the Quran. So it's a really interesting text. But this is not, the Upanishads are not representative of the entirety of Indian religious tradition, right? It's a very specific element of it, or a very specific strain of it. But what I found really interesting is the way that some Muslim scholars from this more comparative tradition try to reconcile the kind of Abrahamic sacred history, the Abrahamic understanding of history and creation, with the Indic one. So one scholar, Abdurrahman Chishti, dies in 1638. He incorporates Indian sacred history into an Islamic sacred historical timeline. And what he does is through talking about sort of Indian sages and avatars are like prophets sent to the jinn, right? So India before was populated by humans, it's populated by jinn. And so a lot of the drama that takes place in kind of the Indian historical pre-time is actually a drama, not with humans, but with jinn, and like sort of prophets sent to jinn, which is really interesting. So that's, I think, a really creative way for Muslim scholars to try and reconcile different timelines, sort of cosmological timelines, which I think was important work to do. And let me see if there's anything I'm leaving out. No, I think that's it. Yeah, I guess that's, there's so much more to talk about, but those were the points I had to discuss today. So I'm happy to, I guess, you know, hear comments. Yeah. I don't know how many questions I'll be able to answer, but maybe I'd love to hear your opinions.
Well, thank you very much. It was very informative and very enlightening. Unfortunately, we don't have a big crowd, so I'm sure there won't be many questions. But Faisal?
Si.
Mirza Faisal Beg will moderate the...
Rafat Bhai is still here. Agar,
I think he just left.
No, he's going to leave soon.
Yeah, he told me. So you just entertain the questions. I'm sure
I have a question.
Yes.
Gigi, go ahead.
Actually, before that, I would like to mention just a few things. So Shibli Nomani, you know, the great scholar, and he has written so much on different aspects of Islamic thought, and also a very distinguished professor from Aligarh Muslim University, Professor Abdul Aziz Maimani, who was the father of my very dear friend, Muhammad Umar Maiman. Many of you are familiar with him. So I thought that I should mention these two names. And also there was, during the British period, some Muslim scholars preferred not to live in India, so they migrated to Makkah, especially. And Abul Kalam Azad's father was one of them, so that's why Abul Kalam Azad was born in Makkah. And Haji Imdadullah of the Deoband school and those. Mm-hmm. So I think very fascinating, extremely fascinating lecture, and the breadth of his professor Jonathan Brown's knowledge was amazing, and to know all these things, dates and all that. So I just wanted to commend him, and we have so many things in common, and we can maybe meet sometime since I live in.
I would love to.
Right. So, thank you.
Okay, thank you, Madam Bhai. Those who want to ask questions, they can either put their name in the chat box or raise your digital hand. I see Haris Azmi already has asked for. So Haris, go ahead and ask the question, please.
Well, thank you so much. It was very informative and very extensive coverage and, you know, very, very enlightening. My question is very specific, and I just wanted to know, what can you share about the Emperor Aurangzeb? Because he's one of those characters that is very much vilified in the modern Indian history. And anything that you can share that, you know, throws light on his character or personality would be greatly appreciated. Thank you.
I recommend reading the relatively new book on him by Audrey Trushk. Her last name is kind of hard to spell. I think it's T-R-U. S-C-H-K-E, it's called Aurangzeb. It's a very good book. It's relatively short and accessible. And I think that, you know, the way in which South Asian history is politicized, has been politicized, is, it's very unfortunate, because it's just designed to, it's sort of self-defeating, and it's designed to make kind of a healthy view of the world around you impossible in a lot of ways. I think going back to the British, so the British, in order to kind of justify their presence, they portrayed, you know, they said Indian history is basically this kind of, the ancient India was this land of wisdom on the sort of Sanskritic wisdom, and then the sort of the dark ages of Muslim rule And now we British are here to kind of return you to enlightenment and things like that. So the British had a vested interest in portraying the period of kind of Persianate age that Richard Eaton talks about as being one of darkness and kind of violence and intolerance. When of course it was really under the British that these lines, the kind of communal lines are solidified even in the 19th and even the 20th century, right? And are exploited as a divide and conquer, method. So, in that narrative, Aurangzeb is this sort of he screws up because he's too Muslim, right? The way that you are successful in India is when you're not really Muslim. Right? So in order to be successful Muslim in India, you have to be not really Muslim. That's the kind of the message that the Aurangzeb lesson is supposed to give in the modern kind of Indian narrative. And if you take it in the kind of BJP Indian nationalist narrative, then Aurangzeb is just another one of the worst, these horrible Muslim rulers who destroy temples and treat Hindus badly, et cetera, et cetera. But that's just not, that's not an accurate understanding of Aurangzeb. Aurangzeb was an Indian ruler. So he's Muslim, but he's Indian, right? So he has some temples destroyed. He builds some temples. He takes away land from some temples. He endows some temples. And Richard Eaton has talked about this extensively, as so does Audrey Tschuch, which is that Muslim rulers and Hindu rulers in Indian history, doing things like destroying temples or supporting them were political actions. Right? If someone's your friend, you support their temple. If someone's your enemy, you destroy their temple. It doesn't matter if they're Hindu or Muslim, right? Then the issue of, to what extent was he, did he kind of turn away from the tolerant legacy of Akbar and Shah Jahan? I don't think that's really... during the time of Aurangzeb, he spent most of his career campaigning in the Deccan, right? Trying to expand Mughal rule. And that arguably his biggest mistake was doing that and not kind of tending to the core areas of the Mughal empire and not making sure that his sons were going to be effective rulers after him. But, by his time, a lot of the, things like the kind of burgeoning Maratha power, these groups had already started to rebel against the Mughals. So there wasn't like he imposed the jizya and stuff. Yeah, maybe that was a bad decision, but from his calculation, this was going to make some people happy, and the people that was going to upset were already upset at him, right? So he didn't really, I think it was sort of, maybe it was a bad decision, but I don't think it was a kind of one that was made out of irrational fanaticism. I think it was a calculation. And this is the same kind of decision that any ruler in South Asia would be presented with. And he was acting like a South Asian ruler. And Richard Eaton talks about this in his book, in India and the Persianate Age, which is a great example. He goes back to the 1000s, and he shows how differently Indian, we think historically about, let's say, Mahmud Ghazna's invasion of India versus invasions of some parts of the Deccan into other parts of around kind of Bengal, right? So why is it that one of them is from the outside and one of them is the inside? Like, it only makes sense if you already have this idea that there's this historical thing called India that has boundaries and borders. But the fact of the matter is, people are fighting against each other and conquering each other and destroying this and supporting that. And it's only if we decide that kind of being Muslim or not, or make somebody Indian or not, that those lines start taking shape around, what is India and what isn't. So I think that's an important thing to keep in mind. And histories of Aurangzeb. And I mean, it's shocking. I'm sorry, I'm taking a long time answering this question.
Yeah, can
I
would just say,
I would just say it's shocking when you look at I can't believe some of the stuff I read by Indian scholars. Like, kind of Hindu Indian scholars on Islamic the history of the Middle Ages India. The stuff they write is, if I wrote that about anybody, I would be fired. I mean, it would be so horrifically intolerant the way they talk. I mean, some things like, you know, it's not conceivable that anybody would actually convert to Islam out of free will. Like, I've literally seen that written by in academic publications by Indian scholars. Like, who is intolerant here? I don't know what to say, except that way of telling history is backward. I would never accept it.
Right, thank you. So, Sayed Hussain, you're next.
You mentioned the Hijaz as the center of learning a lot. What about the Jame Al-Azhar? That has any influence on Indian scholars? And the second question is another Alim Al-Ghazali also is vilified. He has any influence in India?
Al-Ghazali?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, he does. You know, the canon of the, I'd say that other people have a lot more. If you're sort of the Sufi tradition, so Ghazali as a jurist was Shafi, which means he's going to have limited. I mean, his work had already been superseded in the Shafi school. As a theologian, he's, you know, Ashari. His work had already been superseded by other later scholars. As a Sufi, you know, his most influential book is the Ihya Ulum-ud-Din, which does get discussed. And I remember there's one scholar who brings a copy of it, I think even in like part of it's in Ghazali's own hand, to India in the 1500s, and that's really treasured. But there, I'd say he's, if you look in terms of India in the 1400s, 1500s, 1600s, 1700s, the scholars from the Sufi tradition who are really paid attention to a lot more. Suhrawardi, who died, I think, 1245 in Iraq. Rumi, especially in the 1600s and 1700s, Muslim scholars love writing commentaries on Rumi, Masnavi. Of course, Ibn Arabi is very influential. So Ghazali, it's not that he's not important. It's just that he's, in a lot of ways, his work had been superseded by people like Ibn Arabi and Rumi and later figures.
All right, thank you. There was a question from Sayed Hassan, but I think he has left, so I'm going to skip that. Next one is Iram Gul. You have a couple of questions. You want to go ahead? And after that will be Dr. Abdul Jabbar and Monojit Chatterjee. Iram Gul?
Yeah, thank you. I want to ask why scholars in India wrote commentaries of books of Ahadith, whether it was needed or some other reason was there?
And Professor Brown, yeah. Request to keep it short, please.
Yeah. You know, I don't know why they did. I think that's a really good question. Because other people in the Muslim world didn't, from the same time, did not do that. And it's not that they were any more or less Muslim. I think they just got, they really got, I don't know. I think they just, this genre of writing became really valued and important, and people, it was their way of honoring the prophet, I think. That's one theory. It's just, that was their way of honoring the prophet.
All right, thank you. Abdul Jabbar?
Yeah, thank you. A great presentation. I didn't know a lot of history about Islam. I come from a very briefly, I would like to kind of, you talked about everything happened in the north. I come from a rural coastal part of Tamil Nadu, southmost part of India. So I also come from a village as 100% Muslims. I always wondered about how this came about. Do you have any insight into the spread of Islamic traditions in other parts of India? Because there's something I always wondered about it. How come? So
yeah, I don't know. I mean, there's Richard Eaton has a great book called The Rise of Islam on the Bengal Frontier, which I recommend reading. I think there's a lot of different theories about kind of why conversion to Islam happens at various points. There's some theories that, you know, kind of lower castes people become Muslim because it's sort of a way of escaping that and entering into a more, not egalitarian, but a more egalitarian community. Of course, the irony is then that Muslims basically recreate the caste system internally within in Islam with things like Pak and Napak and things like that. What's very interesting is the areas where you have the most intensive conversion or comprehensive conversion to Islam in the population in Bengal and the Punjab are outside the areas of the kind of Hindu caste to sort of you know, Brahminic tradition, right? So the areas that are within the sort of, because, you know, like Hindu Brahmins in the 1500s or something, if they would go to Bengal, they'd have to like purify themselves when they came back, because this was, it's like you went outside the borders of, of your world, right? So the places where there's the most intensive conversion to Islam are the places that were not really within the Hindu religious universe before. And I wonder, I don't know the answer about whether or not there's some elements in Tamil Nadu that are similar to that, but I don't know. But I would look at Richard Eaton's book on the rise of Islam in the Bengal frontier as a source.
Thank you.
Monolith Chatterjee, you're next. Unmute yourself.
Thank you. I agree strongly with Jonathan's issue about, you know, description of the role of Aurangzeb. He is vilified, and he is vilified for a number of reasons to do with, you know, I don't know, the killing of Guru Gobind and Shivaji's son and so on. But that was a time when India was not India. It was a series of, the Mughal Empire had got too big. It couldn't be controlled centrally. He spent more than half his life trying to control other parts of the country and so on. And the narrative that we see is, you could explain that narrative in more than one way. And the narrative which is now becoming the definitive nationalist narrative is this Hindu versus Muslim thing. But it's actually a regional conflict that was taking place at the time. There were Muslims in Shivaji's armies. There were Muslims in the Guru's armies. So it was not Muslim versus Sikh or Muslim versus Hindu. It was Punjabi versus the center. It was Maharashtrian versus the center. And the over-centralization of the country was Aurangzeb's great, great failure. And it directly paved the way for the coming of the British. And in particular, because the Mughal Raj had disintegrated to the point where when the Battle of Plassey took place, it was not Mir Jafar who betrayed Sirajuddin, it was the Mughal Emperor. This was a vassal of the Mughal Emperor fighting a foreign power, and the Mughal Emperor sent him no aid whatsoever, and Bengal was lost. And it was the richest part of the country at the time. So it was a regional conflict which has been going on for a long, long time. The one thing, if anything, that came good from the British rule, it was the idea that we as a people had to rise together. And that is indeed what happened during the Great Uprising in 1857. It was the first time that we actually rose together against a common people, not some Maharajas and Sultans or any of that, common people, ordinary soldiers of all communities rose together against a foreign invader.
Yeah, I think it's, you know, I'm not Indian. I really like South Asia. I mean, I know that's sort of a stupid thing to say, but I mean, I don't see how, you know, anytime, if you try to apply a really simplistic lens to such a complicated place, I can't see how that ends up leading to something good. I mean, you have to have a view that is going to be a little bit more permissive and flexible. Otherwise, I just don't know how this, such a deep and broad universe can be managed. And, you know, what's really interesting is the extent to which, you know, when the Europeans first, like the Portuguese first came and the British first came to India in the, you know, the 1500s and stuff. And they encountered these, like some of the states in the Deccan had, and on the coast of Malabar coast, they had like cannon making technology that was way better than the Portuguese. It's really interesting. They had they were exceptionally good arms makers. And then even when you look at the kind of the history of the British takeover of you know, kind of from roughly 1757 to around 1800, they were, you know, it was not, it was a really close call, right? I mean, if there had been one or two decisions made differently by rulers, you know, of the great states of India in the 1700s, the East India Company would have been cast into the sea. And the, you know, the British had really unmatched fighting skills when they came, but then the different Indian states learned these from their French advisors, and they were as the, they really gave the British army run for its money over and over again. And it was, you know, it was like a close call, you know, one or two things had happened differently, and it would have been a very different history. So I think even this, yeah, go, sorry.
So I said, but at no stage during that time between 1757 and 1800, did the various Indian rulers, bless them, rise together. So the British were able to fight in Bengal separately. Then they took Hyder Ali and Tipu Sultan separately. At no point did these people communicate. The first time we did that, and we almost won in 1857, that was a very, very close call indeed, and could have gone either way. But that was the first time we had something called a sense of a nation.
Yeah, I think that's totally correct. I mean, it's if they had just been like one or two slight differences in alliance, you know, who was aligned with who in the 1770s or 80s, it would have been game over for the British in South Asia.
Right. Thank you. That was the last question. Razi Bhai, back to you.
Well, so I guess everybody is happy now with the questions and responses. Well, we don't have that many questions anymore. So can you show me the next slide?
Okay, just one second.
So, well, thank you very much, Professor Jonathan Brown, sir. It is a really very informative and very enlightening lecture. And I hope that most of our audience has learned a lot. Coming lecture is from Jamia Millia Islamia, Delhi. And though we stand with this, but I'm not so sure about the speaker's health. Last night he called me that he is having high fever, and with the corona epidemic there, I just wish him well and hope that he recovers and he doesn't have it. So he will be the next speaker. But in case he doesn't, then we will have some emergency speaker coming to our coming Saturday.